Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Anthony Albanese makes a welcome return. Mr. Albanese has been a good friend of the Sydney Institute for a long time, and it's great to have him back. He's been here on many occasions. And also we had Karen Middleton here when the book on Anthony Albanese came out. I think that was called Elbow, was it not?
No, Albanese.
Albanese, was it?
There we are.
Italian Street. I think it's going in, going into paperback. Now, you all know our speaker well tonight. I'll introduce him, therefore, very briefly. The member for Grainler since 1996. He held senior positions in opposition and in government and again in opposition. He was leader of the House during the Labor government, and of course he rose to the position of Deputy Prime Minister and currently a shadow minister for infrastructure, transport, cities and regional development, and also tourism. And tonight Mr. Albanese is going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of partnering with our cities. Mr. Albanese, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and it's good to be back here at the Sydney Institute. I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of country and pay my respect to elders past and present. I acknowledge a few familiar faces that are in the crowd here, but particularly Terry Sheen, a distinguished former minister here in New South Wales and party president, who I worked with as an ALP official. I appreciate you making the effort, and there's a range of other familiar faces. Good to see you. There's a reason why people say that all politics is local. That's because it is. The condition of local roads, the evenness of footpaths, availability at the local childcare centre or school, if there's a corner store or a shopping strip close to home, whether the bus comes on time, and if there's somewhere to play sport. These local issues determine the quality of life of all of our citizens. Importantly, they also feed into our nation's larger economic narrative. They determine whether our cities and our towns function well, and if they are places of opportunity where people can live out their aspirations. These aspirations, of course, extend beyond individual needs to family, community, environment, and indeed to encompass a fair nation. Because the quality of life for every individual cannot be isolated from the well-being of the community in which that individual resides. The productivity, sustainability and livability of our cities depends on a range of factors, including how easy it is for people to get around, access to jobs, education and training, urban amenity and quality of life. But we know that the shift from a traditional manufacturing economy to a knowledge-intensive economy means that job opportunities have been increasingly concentrated in the CBDs of our major cities. This has implications for housing affordability and for our transport networks. We know that rapid urbanisation is placing immense pressure on our outer suburbs in particular. Often these areas don't have the necessary infrastructure and services in place to support population growth. And we also know that the end of the resources boom has left a number of regional cities and surrounding towns facing increasing unemployment and declining local economies. And if we add to this equation the rise in automation and shifting demographics, then we start to comprehend the size of the challenge at hand. Our nation is undergoing a period of significant change, and this change can be hard for people who must adjust to the upheaval it brings. Author Mary Shelley wrote that, and I quote, "Nothing is so painful to the human mind as a great and sudden change," end quote. This is absolutely true. It's also true that within change lies opportunity, and it is the responsibility of government to seek this out. Managing this change will not be easy, but one thing is certain. A failure to plan and build the infrastructure that will be needed will leave many people and communities socially isolated and economically disadvantaged. American economist and urbanist Edward Glaser worded it best when he said, "People, not structures, really determine a city's success." Successful cities are inclusive cities with diverse, vibrant communities, not disconnected enclaves of privilege and disadvantage. Collaboration across all levels of government is critical if we're to overcome spatial inequality, which is already being felt in parts of our cities. I firmly believe that someone's postcode should not automatically give you an indication of their income. This principle has been at the centre of a dispute just a couple of kilometres from here about whether public housing should be maintained at Miller's Point and the Rocks. The expulsion of people from their homes, some of whom had lived in those homes for all of their 8 decades on this earth, in my view, had a devastating impact not just on those individuals, but I'd argue also that the surrounding local economy, community, is all the poorer for it. A few weeks ago, the Australian Local Government Association held its annual conference in Canberra. Colloquially, around Parliament House, this is referred to as Mayor a Minute. There's almost 300 local councils attended that conference, 800 delegates, and the fact is it was impossible to meet everyone who wanted to see us. But of those that I did meet, including the Shire of Murray from Western Australia, the City of Melbourne with its new Lord Mayor, Lake Macquarie and other Hunter Valley councils, what's clear to me is that it is still the case that many local councils are thinking comprehensively about what they can do to positively shape the economic future, not just of their own local government area, but indeed of their region. They're thinking strategically about how innovation can be used to advantage the people that they represent through job creation. And they're thinking about how they can work with neighbouring councils, engage the private sector, and bring together all levels of government to achieve positive structural change that empowers a broader geographical area beyond their own. This truly is nation building from the bottom up. The national government should and can do more to support these ambitions. I commend the current government for their participation in urban policy. This stands in stark contrast to the Abbott regime. The reality is, however, that their City Deals program is a poor imitation of the UK model it seeks to replicate, with funding commitments that are determined from the top down and have been tied to the electoral cycle. That's why tonight I'm announcing that a shortened Labor government will overhaul and replace the Coalition government's City Deals program with a new, more rigorous program called City Partnerships. This is consistent with Labor's approach to depoliticise infrastructure by making generational, evidence-based decisions. Labor will work with local government in a way that is genuine, in a way that supports their expertise, and in a way that brings people together to build a strategic vision underpinned by real investment in our cities, so that we can ensure their ongoing productivity, sustainability and livability. Australia is not the only country grappling with urban population growth. However, the reality is that whilst we are and have been for some time one of the most urbanised countries on the planet, we are accelerating that process. Already, almost 90% of all Australians live in our urban areas. What's more, projections from Infrastructure Australia indicate that by 2031, the populations of our 4 largest capitals, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and Perth, will have increased by some 46%. Adelaide, Canberra, Hobart and Darwin will grow by nearly 30%. Regional cities are also growing rapidly, with an extra 1 million people expected to call these cities home by 2020. And although there are significant potential benefits that come from this increased urbanisation, including a greater contribution to GDP, we also know that the negative side effects are taking a toll on our cities. Urban sprawl, growing congestion on roads and public transport, declining housing affordability, and an unequal distribution of employment opportunities, particularly for our outer suburbs and growth areas, have an impact on people's quality of life. Our natural environment is suffering through increased pollution and the loss of green space when urban development is poorly planned. And our agricultural food bowls, which play a critical role in supplying our cities, are also under pressure. The national government has a responsibility to work with the state and local governments to address these problems. Given that major cities are increasingly important actors in their own right within the global economy, we must ensure that they are competitive. Subnational activities by state governments influence economic development, investment facilitation and trade outcomes, as well as the local innovation system. So to improve our national economic performance, we must be more strategic in the way we approach issues such as congestion for freight as well as for commuters, urban renewal and employment clusters. And of course, in doing so, we make our cities better places to live for all of our citizens. But climate change complicates this policy challenge because of its significant impact on the urban environment through the heat island effect, higher sustained temperatures and extreme weather events. While cities cover less than 2% of the Earth's surface, they are responsible for about 70% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Getting planning and infrastructure right within our cities is critical if we are to reduce Australia's harmful carbon emissions, meet the Paris targets, and move forward towards a zero emissions future. Consequently, we need considered policy responses from governments for the long term, not just band-aid solutions. We need to get the governance structures right as a precondition for then getting specific policies right. And because the nature of Australia's federation means that all three levels of government have both distinct but as well overlapping roles in urban development, collaboration and alignment are needed to maximise the effectiveness of investments and policy. When Labor was last in government, we established the foundations for this collaboration and alignment. We created the Major Cities Unit. We created the Urban Policy Forum to implement that policy informed by expert opinion and underpinned by an evidence base, including through the annual State of Australian Cities reports. That was an extensive document that was downloaded more than 3 million times, the three reports, just showing that there is a great desire out there for facts upon which to then base policy recommendations. We established the Australian Council of Local Government to bring local councils into the conversation. When I first proposed to my cabinet colleagues that they would meet every one of the 550 mayors and shire presidents in Canberra over 2 days and one night, this was not met with automatic acclaim. After the event, they recognised that every single one of us learnt a lot from engaging with people who we wouldn't ordinarily engage with on a day-to-day basis. And what's more, those people learn a lot off each other as well. So it really improved the relationship between the national government and local government in a very practical way. We also created at the University of Technology the Centre of Excellence for Local Government to promote best practice. Through COAG, we conducted a review of capital city strategic planning systems. It's no accident that the chair was Brian Howe, the deputy chair was Lucy Turnbull. Again, an attempt to make sure that the reform lasted just beyond one term of government or one side of politics being in charge. An attempt to depoliticise the process that is so important for the medium and long term. And we released Australia's first ever comprehensive national urban policy, which identified those three pillars of productivity, sustainability and livability as the targets. The City Partnerships program will build on this approach. City Partnerships will engage all three levels of government through genuine collaboration as well as with the private sector to set out a strategic vision for our cities. This will be linked to a renewed national urban policy. I'm pleased there is bipartisanship on the need for federal government engagement in our cities. However, the truth is that the current City Deals program does fall short of what's required to deliver real change. The lack of rigour and independent oversight means that City Deals are subject to political whim. The absence of transparency and clear guidelines has left local councils unsure as to how they can best participate. And limited engagement with the private sector and the lack of clarity around funding of projects means that all levels of government are missing out on potential value uplift. The fact is that City Deals have either been in marginal electorates framed around single election commitments or are simply missing depth and detail. This is the case for the Western Sydney City Deal, where not only was Blacktown Council excluded for reasons beyond my comprehension, but it also still has an unfunded rail project as its centrepiece. Just this month, Bill Shorten announced at the New South Wales ALP conference that Federal Labor will partner with the New South Wales Government to provide real investment for Western Sydney Rail, consistent with our determination to make public transport a defining priority for a shortened Labor government. But it's not just me providing criticism of City Deals tonight. Stakeholders have echoed precisely these concerns. For instance, Marcus Spiller, the principal and partner at SDS, commented that the City Deals program, and I quote, comes perilously close to the Commonwealth picking individual project winners rather than facilitating structural change. Romilly Maddu, CEO of the Green Building Council, said that, and I quote, you should meet these targets. It shouldn't be just here's the money as part of a city deal. They should also have to meet a whole lot of requirements. And Adam Beck, the Executive Director of the Smart Cities Council, pointed out that, and I quote, the city deals process, from what I understand, has no industry committee, no outside support. Working it together in collaboration is the only model. We can and we must do better. City deals, of course, originate from the UK, where there have been a number of extremely successful deals put in place. Of course, it is easier when you have two tiers of government rather than three. But they're intended to provide a mechanism through which various levels of government can work together to develop area-based strategies that improve overall economic growth. Part of this process involves setting targets in areas like employment, affordable housing, and sustainability. In large cities, such as Melbourne or Sydney, the City Deals concept can be applied to sub-metropolitan areas, regions and precincts. Western Sydney City Deal is an example of this. But it also provides a model through which growth corridors and regional cities can receive greater support and investment. This is particularly important given these areas face substantially different challenges to inner cities. Ultimately, City Deals are intended to provide a long-term vision for how structural change can be achieved. This can encompass the built form, economy and community, depending on the needs of the area. In turn, this enables consideration of long-term benefits, such as increase in land value and improved productivity as a direct consequence of greater investment. Funding from all levels of government can be pooled and/or aligned, and in some instances also accompanied by co-investments by the private sector. In some cases, earn back and other innovative financing models have been used. Most crucially, city deals are underpinned by the idea that investment should be guided by the level of government that sits closest to the people. They encourage a bottom-up strategy that involves community, that recognises local government as genuine partners, well-placed to lead structural change and to foster local community ownership. This innovative approach to multi-level governance is particularly applicable to Australia's federal system of government. Despite local government lacking constitutional recognition, it plays a critical role in shaping our cities, particularly through strategic land use planning and development facilitation, public works and its ability to drive community engagement and ownership of projects. State governments are also critical with oversight of strategic land use planning activities, the operation of transport systems, and providing most of the funding for infrastructure and major facilities. However, given the significance to the national economy, the Commonwealth must also have an active role in urban policy using the various levers that are at our disposal. Bringing all levels of government together is important, and that requires national leadership. The Property Council has identified critical foundations for improving Australia's cities, including a national framework that actively shapes urbanisation to achieve long-term goals, and, quote, long-lasting agreements, deals and partnerships between different levels of governments. But of course we know that the most important lever remains direct, targeted investment in nationally significant infrastructure. The Commonwealth also controls other policy and regulatory levers on both the supply and demand side. These include taxation and immigration, the national coordination of housing supply through the Housing Supply Council, which Labor will re-establish, and funding to the states and territories for key services, such as housing and homelessness. In addition to this, the Commonwealth owns strategic parcels of land in major cities and plays a role in supporting important economic infrastructure such as hospitals, universities and airports. To date, all states and territories have shown interest in the current City Deals program. So we know there's a willingness to collaborate, but we have to get the framework right. Our proposed city partnerships will strengthen this process by better engaging local government and the private sector and ambitiously structuring collaboration to achieve clearly defined outcomes and targets. City partnerships will also build on Labor's proud urban policy legacy. Since World War II, every Labor government has made an important contribution to Australia's urban development and progress. Of course, Ben Chifley commenced post-war reconstruction with large-scale investment in public housing. Gough Whitlam connected Western Sydney and other suburban areas to sewerage and also established the Department of Urban and Regional Development. Bob Hawke and Paul Keating invested in the Building Better Cities program. And the Rudd and Gillard governments put in place a large number of policies to support the development of cities that I outlined earlier. In recent years, however, we have seen how the short-termism of the electoral cycle sometimes functions as a handbrake on necessary national economic reform. Big decisions can be suspended or delayed, and immediate political priorities can get in the way of the long-term national interest. We need to overcome this challenge. City Partnerships provides a model through which this can be achieved. Our policy comes from months of consultation with local governments and experts from across the sector, including, of course, the private sector. We've listened to councils talk about the need for all three levels of government to work together, but in a way that's meaningful. I've met with state governments about these issues, where local government is treated as a genuine partner rather than just as another stakeholder, where all cards are on the table from the outset and priorities are determined in collaboration. Around the nation, local government is already thinking about how such a model might work. In the Hunter Valley, Lake Macquarie, Maitland, Newcastle, Port Stephens and Cessnock councils have come together to advocate for completing the delivery of the Glendale Interchange. Thereafter, a $13 million investment. The first stage was invested in, has been constructed. It needs that contribution, though, from the Commonwealth. That $13 million will unlock 6,000 jobs in the private sector, $700 million of private sector investment, including the expansion of Stockland at Glendale. This is much more than an infrastructure project. This is a transformative project which will act as a catalyst for the entire region, transforming the way that people get around, attracting businesses, creating jobs, and facilitating urban renewal in the Cardiff industrial area. In Western Australia, the city of Stirling is thinking about how it will house a growing population and ensure there are jobs within its local community for residents. The city of Stirling is planning now for the future and considering what infrastructure is required to support this growth through its Stevenson Avenue Urban Regeneration Project, which Bill Shorten and I announced funding for in April of this year, to add to commitments already made by the local government and the WA state government. Stage two of this project includes a light rail connection from the Stirling City Centre to the iconic Scarborough Bridge, a beach. This project will provide more than 82,000 new ongoing jobs, unlock $16 billion worth of private investment, create over 30,000 new dwellings, which will generate the capacity to house over 63,000 new residents. It's been worked on, including with the private sector, with Westfield, sitting around the table, collaborating with the different levels of government about what can be achieved. The Council of Mayors for South East Queensland, which encompasses 10 local government areas, has put aside parochialism to give substantial consideration of the future of its region. And in 2014, before the Coalition Government even announced its City Deals program, the Council of Mayors had started work on a model for Queensland. Possibly one of the most significant achievements from my time as the Minister for Infrastructure and Regional Development was the establishment of Infrastructure Australia in 2008. This set an important precedent for a rigorous and transparent approach to investing in infrastructure, ensuring evidence-based decision-making guided the Commonwealth's allocation of funds. We remain committed to this approach, and that's why we will re-establish the Major Cities Unit within Infrastructure Australia and task it with independent oversight of the City Partnerships Program, including making recommendations to the Minister that will be made publicly. The Major Cities Unit will also take responsibility for refreshing the National Urban Policy that Labor released when in government to ensure that city partnerships align with its objectives, for example, in areas like sustainability and smart technology. We'll ensure that city partnerships are underpinned by a strong evidence base and proper analysis to maximise return on investment and social outcomes. We understand that city partnerships must be tailored and flexible, but we expect them to set out a strategic vision that aligns with the National Urban Policy and delivers on predetermined performance indicators. Effective city partnerships can only be delivered through genuine collaboration with all three levels of government and the private sector. Hence, city partnerships will demand bottom-up strategies that recognise the role of local government as genuine partners as well as landowners and investors, so they are well-placed to drive structural change. There's also an opportunity for the Major Cities Unit to consider how city partnerships can leverage equity investment from government financing bodies such as the CEFC, which have policy goals that cities can have play a role in meeting. An expert panel will be established to update strategic planning guidelines for cities, as well as the development of guidelines which will include benefits to the economy for city partnerships in consultation with the Minister. This will ensure industry expertise is more effectively utilised and that city partnerships align with strategic planning guidelines. It will consider ways in which the community and stakeholders can be more effectively engaged in the development phase of these partnerships. It will also consider ways in which collaboration across local governments, including with council membership organisations such as WESROC in Sydney and the Council of Mayors in South East Queensland, as well as with the private sector, can be incentivised and rewarded. To ensure transparency, these guidelines will be publicly available and applications from any city or cities welcome. The program will apply not just to capital cities, but also to regional cities as part of our ongoing commitment to regional development. We need to grow our regional cities, in and of itself a good idea, but also to take pressure off the major capitals. City partnerships will also be required to focus on what gains can be made through productivity uplift and the additional revenue that will flow to the federal government as a result. This mirrors international examples where, in developing a strategic vision for a particular area, governments were required to consider broader economic objectives, including employment and other earning opportunities. City partnerships also provide a unique opportunity to address spatial inequality in our cities by driving and facilitating investment in outer suburbs and growth areas to enable them to become more productive, sustainable and livable. In conclusion, can I say that renowned urbanist Jane Jacobs once declared that lively, diverse, intense cities contain the seeds of their own regeneration. City partnerships aim to achieve precisely this. We want to unlock the potential of our cities, inner urban areas, regional cities, outer suburbs and growth areas, by bringing together all levels of government, the private sector and the community in a way that is meaningful so that we achieve genuine structural change. My mentor and former Deputy Labor Leader Tom Uren previously said that with urban policy we could no longer deal with things in boxes anymore. If anything, cities are even more complex now than they were at the time of the creation of the Department of Urban and Regional Development. With advances in technology, we'll always experience change. But getting processes right provides us with the best opportunity to deal with this head on and ensure that our cities are indeed productive, sustainable and livable. Not just for those that can afford it, but for everyone. Not for some of us, but for all of us. Thanks very much.
Many thanks, Anthony Albanese. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish, no doubt, at the top of the hour. There are a lot of people here, so I should keep your question or your comment brief, like this. You've spoken a lot about past Commonwealth governments, and in particular past Labor governments. You've spoken about your relationship, what you're doing at the moment right now with local government, but As you well know, there's the state governments there as well, and some are coalition, some are Labor. Do you see that as a problem or as an opportunity? Because, as you know, they play a pretty important role in all of that.
I see it essentially as an opportunity. As I said in the address, when we looked at the framework for cities planning, it was a very conscious decision to have Brian Howe and Lucy Turnbull, two very distinguished people in their own right, but with links to different sides of politics engaged. We have got support for the Infrastructure Australia model. Not only has been replicated by state governments, both Labor and Conservative, it's been replicated in New Zealand, replicated in the UK, and is seen as world's best practice in terms of that legislation. So I think if you're about achieving that long-term change beyond periods of any particular side of politics, then it makes sense to collaborate across the political spectrum. The City Deals concept is currently being promoted in the UK by a Conservative government, with local governments in places like Liverpool and Birmingham and Manchester that are dominated by Labor at that level. And that has worked very well. What we had with the Western Sydney City deal was signed with the Turnbull government by Labor mayors of Campbelltown, Liverpool, Penrith and the Blue Mountains. Fairfield is an independent, I think. But they were involved in that. The problem is they weren't able to see what everyone else was getting from the city deal before they signed. It wasn't genuinely open and collaborative, which is why if you open it all up, then I think there's a great deal of prospect of getting that that broad support from the different levels of government, because state governments have an interest as well. Who said, I think it might have been Paul, never stand between premiers and a bucket of money.
It was originally Jack Lang.
Jack Lang.
And then Paul Keating.
Well, Paul was entitled to take Jack's quotes, I guess, given they spent a great deal of time together. But the fact is there's an incentive for state governments to participate in this process, just as state governments, whatever the flavour across the nation, have participated or are trying to participate in the city deals process.
There's a question here. Now, as I should have said, broadly on the topic questions, yeah?
The
emphasis on broadly.
Thank you. You've concentrated on coastal city development largely in your talk, and I'm wondering if you'd ever considered the possibility of freeing Australians from having to live in the coastal mega cities. And in particular, you could possibly open up the country to a lot more development by a project of putting water into the interior, by possibly building a whole bunch of desal plants on the coast and shipping that water through the mountains into the interior. That's expensive, but it's huge. That would transform Australia possibly like nothing else and free us from this coastal megapolis thing. Have you ever considered that?
Yeah. I haven't considered specifically that, but I certainly have considered how you grow regional cities. And I think there's one infrastructure, two infrastructure projects that could certainly do that. That was part of the motivation for the National Broadband Network, like the actually fibre-based 21st century network, not the copper one. And the objective of that was that if you have a business in Orange or Tamworth or Toowoomba that has the same access to domestic and international markets as someone here, a business here in Governor Phillip Tower, the overheads mean that all of a sudden, instead of being at a competitive disadvantage, those businesses are a competitive advantage. And there's an incentive, a market-based incentive, to establish businesses in regional centres. The second is, of course, high-speed rail. I think I gave a talk here at the Sydney Institute about high-speed rail. I remain an advocate for it. I think one of the things that it would do is transform those regional cities. If you had Canberra, for example, is Australia's largest inland city, of course. If it was less than, or well under, an hour from the Sydney CBD, all of a sudden the advantages of, I think Canberra's a great city, all of a sudden, the advantages of living in Canberra become a lot more if you could literally go to the Opera House or go to the things that only a big global city like Sydney can provide on an evening.
I think high-speed rail is a great utopia, I could say. In the notion of...
Actually, it has a benefit-cost ratio of $2, above $2, $2.48 for every dollar invested, so...
In the city partnerships notion that you describe, you talk about three levels of government and business, what do you see in more detail as a role for business? Does it include PPPs?
Well, what it would include potentially is PPPs, absolutely. So take, for example, the airport at Western Sydney. That needs to be seen not just as a runway and a terminal, but as a catalyst for investment. A lot of that investment relies upon a role for government. So, for example, the Science Park, being developed there by Celestino, you're talking about, I think it's 12,000 jobs they're talking about, 4,000 residences, a whole community to the north of the airport that will be, have the first in New South Wales, the first K-12 school, already signed the agreement with the Catholic Education Office to provide that, but what it needs is transport access. It needs a rail line. So quite often, if you have a strategic approach to planning, a contribution by the Commonwealth can unlock massive private sector investment in itself. And the basic concept of the UK city deals is that you take into account the revenue that will come back to government from economic growth, so that if an investment is going to produce over a period of 20 years an additional $1 billion in income taxes, company taxes, etc., to the national government, then it makes sense for the national government, perhaps if that requires a $500 million investment, to do that, because it produces that return. So you have growth at the national level, you also have growth at the local level. So that requires, undoubtedly, collaboration with the private sector. In the city of Stirling's example, there's essentially a Westfield there that's a bit landlocked and a range of private sector investment that require essentially one key road, which is stage one, being changed, unlocks all of that land. All of a sudden it's worth a lot more. So therefore the beneficiary of that unlocking should be prepared to make a financial commitment to it in terms of value capture in a practical way. Now, one of the criticisms I have with the current government is that value capture isn't the panacea. It doesn't automatically... You can't build, for example, the Melbourne Airport rail line just on value capture, or the Western Sydney rail line just on value capture. It does require a contribution. But some of that contribution can be from the private sector, because the private sector will get a return back for it.
There's a question up there.
You spoke about the investments in physical infrastructure, whether it's transport or housing, but a lot of our local governments, as well as our competitors globally, are investing a lot in smart cities initiatives.
Yeah.
What do you think the opportunities are to improve the way that we deliver digital and technology initiatives in Australia?
They are enormous, and it's a... I've given another speech about that to the Smart Cities Conference, so I didn't go into all of that detail. But we're committed, for example, any submission to Infrastructure Australia for infrastructure, it shouldn't be sort of an add-on. I regard that as inclusive. That's part of it. How do you build it in? It's a lot cheaper to get it right the first time than to go back and retrofit it. So that not just in terms of smart infrastructure, in terms of new technology, but sustainability as well. Don't go and retrofit solar panels and water recycling. Do it in best practice. And there's some great examples, including in this city. People love the Central Park facility at Broadway. And there you have a vibrant community. It's a good place to live. It's a sustainable building. I think that what that shows is that if developers get it right as well, you can have increased density. But where people will react is if those things aren't included from the beginning. And that's why you've got a fairly strong response to some of the overdevelopment in cities like Sydney.
Question down there. Richard, yep.
Mr. Albanese, one of the issues in Sydney, as you've already mentioned, is the difficulty of getting on buses, driving around the city. It's just become quite horrendous for so many people, and there's such a productivity loss with people spending far too much time on the road. One of the relatively easy ways for a federal government to do something about it would be to drop immigration from a peak of 300,000 to say 150,000. It'd still be a very high relative per capita immigration program, but it would stop the rate of increase of pressure that is so difficult in this town today.
I think the question of immigration isn't, I don't think that's simple, because what that ignores is the fact that immigration also builds economic activity and provides a basis for economic growth, including returns to government that can then be used for investment. I think it is a matter of making sure that with growth, there is investment in the right infrastructure, and by infrastructure as well. I don't just mean transport infrastructure, I mean schools, hospitals, places for kids to play, all of that. I've got close to me the Woolleye Creek development, and I'm yet to see a new park for the kids to play. I'm yet to see an investment in local schools. There's yet to be an expansion of any of the local health facilities. And I think that is what people react to. If you don't get it right, then you will have a response that looks towards more stark responses, such as cutting immigration numbers. One of the things that we need to do, and that's why, going back to Jared's first question, I think collaboration on these issues isn't really optional. Governments of whatever political persuasion have to deal with these challenges because they are substantial, and they're substantial in terms of the outer suburbs, where historically we've just had growth without thinking about how people get to work, whether there'll be jobs created in the local area, what's the social and community infrastructure around them. And now some of that is happening with the infill, so that you have large growth in populations around Mascot, around Woolleye Creek, etc., without any additional, in part, oh, they've got parks, they don't need another one. We need to make sure that we get it right. That's my concern about some of the debate about the Bankstown to Sydenham corridor in this building, in the state government, in this state. And the state government essentially saying, you know, we'll have a bit of a free-for-all along that railway line. I don't mind increased density around public transport corridors, but it's got to be quality. It's got to be one that brings the community with it. And you can do that. And there's great examples of that all around the various cities.
Anthony, I'm just wondering why state governments are so obsessed with motorways and cars. I live in the same Sutherland Shire, and why don't we put a fast rail between Wollongong and Sydney rather than an ugly motorway right through it? And why aren't we building more cycleways, light rail, heavy rail, walkways for people?
Look, the state government had a recommendation before it, my understanding is, looking at the relative merit of the F6, essentially a motorway, or upgrading the rail line. It found the rail line was much cheaper, much better value, but of course they went with the road. Why do they do that? Because if you have a view of infrastructure that is increasingly looking at infrastructure as just equity investments rather than a grant that impacts on the budget, inevitably you end up with toll roads. That's my criticism of the recent budget. There was a grand announcement about $5 billion for Melbourne Airport Rail, and there was also a grand announcement about Western Sydney Rail through the new airport. In the budget, there wasn't a dollar for construction of either. What there was a little note saying we hope that this can be achieved. The Melbourne Airport Rail, for example, can be achieved through an equity investment. Now, an equity investment, I'm trying to think of how to simplify this, essentially in order to be eligible to be off budget, that is not to hit a bottom line and impact on the deficit, what it has to be is an income producing asset. So it's not a cost to government. So an income producing asset, when it comes to Western Sydney, when it comes to Melbourne Airport Rail, for example, is just a nonsense. The average, because it has to achieve two criteria. One, the income through the fare box, the fares that passengers pay, has to be greater than the operating and maintenance cost of that rail line. Now, the average is about 20 to 25% is what the fare box contributes for any rail line around Australia. And that's because the benefit of a rail line isn't to the owner, isn't direct. It's not a commercial transaction. It's a benefit to the national economy. It's how people get to work. It's how the economy functions. It's how people get to the footy and you know, the benefits are in other places, the surplus, if you like, return. But secondly, also, that doesn't take into account, it also has to produce a return on capital. So if you've got a $10 billion rail line, you've made this investment, you not only are not going to meet the ongoing costs, you're never going to pay back your loan, if you like, on the $10 billion. So I said in a conference just across the road at the Sofitel here to the Financial Review Infrastructure Conference just a little while ago. It was full of business people and people from the sector. If anyone wants to buy that, buy into that, put your hand up. I've got lots of deals for you. Because it's just farcical. And that's why when governments are looking at projects and looking at bottom lines in a really narrow sense, you end up with toll roads because they do produce a return. They produce a return so that in this city, in just a few years' time, we will be the most heavily tolled city in the world. In the world, bar none. And that is a big issue. And eventually there will be a response to that, and that's why governments can't continue to go down that road. So that the other thing that happened was that when Tony Abbott came to office, he cut all funding in any public transport project. So Parramatta Epping Rail Line, Melbourne Metro, Cross River Rail, all went, and up came toll roads in their place, which was really, from Tony's perspective, outlined in Battle Lines, really an ideological thing about the car representing individualism versus the collectivism of public transport. Who knows, you might have to sit next to someone you don't know. I caught the train here tonight. It's the most efficient way to get here.
So there'll be a final question here. Yeah.
The Greater City Commission released its 40-year plan for the cities. I'm wondering if you can offer your thoughts on that, but also what you anticipate the role would be for a cities unit with an IA that would help you engage with such a predetermined plan with such a long-term vision as well.
Look, I think I certainly welcome the fact that it's creation, and I welcome the fact that it produced that long-term report. The truth is that those long-term reports have to be revised as practice goes on, and the major cities unit job would be to work with them. Speaking to the Western Sydney councils, for example, who are involved in the Western Sydney City deal, they were very complimentary about the engagement with the Planning Commission, much more so than with the federal government, where they, you know, weren't allowed to talk to each other and that sort of nonsense. But I think that there is certainly a role for the Planning Commission to work with the national body. I see them as complementary rather than as being opposite. And I also have, in terms of the development of city partnerships, it's a conscious decision, and not say everything the current government does is bad and we're going to do everything new and start again. Okay, what's there now? How do you reform it to make it better? How do you look at best practice? How do you collaborate and try and bring people with you on the journey? That's always been my approach to politics, and it's my approach to certainly to cities policy. And the fact is that it's a bit of an example, the Planning Commission, of getting those three cities right, three cities idea. I think there's some issues with that, but it's a major step forward that you have a government putting forward that longer-term vision. So I see that Infrastructure Australia would work with them, would work with other state bodies, as well as with local government to try and take this agenda forward.
I think that's a very good spot on which to finish.
I know there are many more questions and comments, but we have a rule of finishing on time, and that's what we do. At the Sydney Institute, we're very grateful for Anthony Albanese coming here tonight on talking on a major speech on partnerships with Australian cities, between the Commonwealth Government and Australian cities. Mr. Albanese has given a number of very important speeches here over the years, and this is another one. We're very pleased you're here tonight, and just we'll love to have you back in the future. But for tonight, congratulations and good luck.
Thank you very much. One final comment, go the Blues.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.